to fires.
Okay.
I argue about this earlier that we're going to run into this problem, and I ask for change, but I don't know if we can do it. We're going to run into this problem where we have, the session time interfering with our committee time. So I have to apologize to our testifiers, to the public members. We're going to try to do the best we can. And I need to ask members if there is a possibility, and I need a show of hands, that we stay for another hour in committee. Are you able to stay so that we hear the presentation?
I can stay.
You can stay? Members? Yes?
And okay. Madam Chair,
thank you so much. An hour.
I have a commitment in 30 minutes, but I think we can do our initial
absolutely.
Presentation.
Absolutely. We will start with your bill, Senator Wigger, and then we will move into at least beginning the presentation, which is an important presentation about student testing and evaluation. Senator Wigger, please go ahead and start.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair, committee members. Senate File 160 says students should stay in school until they graduate. Right now, the compulsory attendance age is 16, and this would increase it to 18. The majority of states in our country are at 18, that you must stay in school until 18 or graduate, whatever occurs first. Minnesota's on-time graduation rate now is at about 76%. That is unacceptable. There's a number of things that we need to do to improve on graduation rates, and I would say this is a part of that whole formula, and we're going to look at a number of those suggestions this session. I have a lot of data that can show the economic impact of for a student who fails to graduate, the economic impact for that person, for the state, the economic impact for our country. We have a number of research statistics, and I will make those available. I was going to recite those, but in the interest of time, I just want to restate again that there is a huge financial impact for a student who does not graduate in terms of diminished earnings, the at-risk potential for a student that does not graduate, and so we are sending a strong signal saying stay in school, and it would have it until 18 or when you graduate. And again, the majority of states in America have this. I do have an author's amendment, and initially Senator Nienau was going to make it. It addresses some concerns that the homeschool community, John Tuma, is here, but in the interest of harmony and putting the bill in the form that is totally acceptable, Nienau would move, but I make it an author's amendment, the A2 amendment. And as a courtesy to new members, this would put it in the shape that I'd like the bill to
Senator
be.
Senator Wigger moves. I don't have the amendment, Senator Wigger, so I want to make sure. Okay, got it. Thank you. The A2 amendment, and Senator Weir, I want to be clear on this. Are you you want to offer this amendment
yes,
to put
as
the
an
bill in the
amendment.
Shape?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Wigger. Any questions about the amendment? If not, all of those in favor, signifying by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. The amendment is adopted. Thank you, Senator Wigger. Please continue.
Madam Chair, I have two witnesses, and Rams County Attorney Choi was here for over 2 hours. If he can make it back, he will. I thank Dr. Silva for being here. I just want to note that the most recent issue of Education Week has cited top leaders in America in trend-setting education, and right here up on top is Dr. Silva, and congratulations on that. I know that Secretary Duncan has had her on a special task force looking at safe schools and violence, and I'm just very honored to have you, and I would like Superintendent Silva to address the committee on the need for this legislation.
Dr. Silva, welcome to our committee. We're incredibly honored to have you, and congratulations on being recognized as one of our top leaders in education in the country. We knew that long ago, so now you're being recognized nationally, and we look forward to hear your recommendations and your advice as to how do we need to proceed. We are going to be needing your support in terms of developing our ELL policy and figuring out how do we strengthen that and how we put resources into it. So thank you and welcome to our committee.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking the time to listen to our concern on the way the bill is written today. We are the largest school districts in the state. We have grown, and we are the largest. And by the way, I'm committed to stay in St. Paul. I'm not going to any national job because I need to close the achievement gap here to prove to the rest of the country it can happen.
Thank you.
And just as a superintendent who strongly believe education is the only way out of poverty, I would tell you that the bill that is currently on this and that we are using is the 16 has not helped us, the educators. And I'll tell you why. I do believe, I always dream about how do we get to this. I dream that in the past, sometime, we needed 16 or 17 years old students to go and work because they needed to help the family. And I tell you that it's very much what it happened. Many kids have to drop out of high school to help the family to put food on the table. Today, 2013, I can tell you that there's no way a future Minnesotan taxpayer without a high school diploma will be able to make it. How does it help? It helps because we got 17,000 students that they drop out. Our school district since 2007 to now has reduced the dropout rate half. So it's a big, big change. But still, we still had too many dropouts. How does the compulsory bill will help us is families come to us and said, please, please help me to keep my child at school. And we can't do anything because we cannot use our TIP program, and Claudia will explain it to you. The kids cannot, if we want to accomplish from cradle to post-secondary, they will not be able to accomplish this goal of everybody going to college or universities if we don't provide the students with an enforcement on you must stay in high school. At 16, you don't know what you're doing. Maybe you did, but most of our kids don't have a clue what they're doing. So then they drop out, and then they go, and they don't get that education, and they become a very, very high price for our community. And I'm going to leave Claudia to continue with the program that we have been able to use and now is being used across other counties.
Thank you, Superintendent.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, hello and thank you for the opportunity to speak, to let us speak here to you about raising the compulsory school attendance age from 16 to 18. My name is Claudia Perez Insunza, and I work for St. Paul Public Schools in the Truancy Intervention Program. I am here today to give you a sense from the school perspective of this very effective partnership and how compulsory attendance law fits into it. TIP is a valuable program in partnership between the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, as well as many other community partners who assist us to removing barriers for school attendance, to keep all of our students in school until they graduate. But perhaps the most important relationship is the one that we have with students and families. Briefly, a TIP process is built on several success steps. The first step is a group of meeting at school where families and students hear about the law and the consequences regarding attendance. The students may be referred to this meeting after three or more unexcused attendance. About 60% of all these students will not need any further intervention. The second step is the attendance doesn't improve, a student is referred to a school attendance review team. We call a SAR hearing. SAR is where the school staff, along with Ramsey County and the parents of guardians, develop a plan for successful school attendance for each individual student. In fact, this is what I was doing this morning before I came here to you. In St. Paul, we assigned student monitor last year 254 students, and 70% of these students improved their attendance. The third step is filling a truancy petition in juvenile court. Ideally, we do not need to get to the legal action to get students in school. So to resolve these issues in a positive way early on keep relationships with our students and families. From my experience, family wants their students in school. School staff wants their students in school. But sometimes the students know that after 16, they don't have to be in school. World gets around, and they know that legally we have no leverage after they turn 16. We lose these students. As the superintendent said, the average age of students referred to TEEP is 15.5 years old. That doesn't give us too much time to get them back on track. Some students will continue working with us anyway, but for these who don't want to, the compulsory attendance age is a tool to keep them working with us. This is not the only tool to improve attendance and continue reducing our dropout rate, but we need every tool we can to make sure that every student stays in school until they get to the diploma. Thank you again for the support and to let us speak here with you today.
Thank you, Mrs. Perez. Any questions for Senator Thompson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent. Did I understand correctly that you said that parents want their kids to stay in school, but the kids drop out anyway?
Ms. Silva.
Madam Chair, members of the board, and Senator Thompson, I have some of my, because I speak Spanish, and I attend to many meetings with Latino parents, I have parents crying, saying, please help me. Because when the kid doesn't get out of bed, and they don't have any other help, and they know they need an education, they don't have the law that supports it. Claudia has had the opportunity to work with many families in which we give them an alarm. We do this and that, and we pick them up. We try to get them in school, but it still doesn't work. Some families do want the kids to be at school.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Manager. But under current law, the children still have to attend school unless a parent or guardian signs a form of withdrawal. Isn't that correct?
16.
You're supposed to approve it.
Ms. Silva.
Madam Chair, members of the board, I'm hearing they're supposed to approve it, and they may not approve it, and then they can be out and about for about 6 to 8 months until we catch up with that. It is an issue, and many of our parents didn't have an education. And they did get out of high school at age 16. And they know that, well, okay, you're just following my steps. The state and you, and legislators, are talking about making the schools accountable for a higher graduation rate. Then give us the tools. We know this will help us to get to where we need to be and not be one of the graduation rates that we have today.
Thank you, Senator. And I think that because the language, it's my understanding, you know, the language is very specifically in defining 16. So I have been part of some of these meetings as well, in which, you know, some kids actually do know what's in the law. We don't think that they do, but they do. And so really we're leaving the schools and the districts without really any legal support when a kid, I remember having some meetings for kids who are in foster care, in and out of foster care, and we have the whole issue of, you know, the parents, these children being in placement with individuals and relatives that are not their parents, and then the kids are 16, and then the foster parents are coming to the school trying to ask for help. So it's a there's a lot of complexity because the age that is defined in legislation is 16. That's my understanding. I remember I work with foster care children and child protection for a number of years, and I remember foster parents having significant problems with this and wanted to extend that to 18. Excuse me, Senator Chamberlain has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with the premise here, but it was made known to me that there's some research out there that suggests that there's not a direct correlation between higher graduation rates and higher the CSA age going up. Could you address that?
Yeah, we can't hear you.
I'm sorry.
The door open.
I'm sorry. There was a report, a study I was made aware of that suggested that there's not a strong correlation or any correlation really between increasing these dropout ages and the graduation rate. So could you just address that, what you think about that?
And Madam Chair, members of the board, and Senator Chamberlain.
How you doing?
My great-grandfather had that last name, so now I'm looking at it, sorry. But it was pronounced Chamberlain because we are Chileans.
You can say that. That sounds better, actually.
We ate the I.
I'm going to adopt that.
So then, I've been pronouncing it that way.
Tell my wife tonight, it's Chamberlain.
Yeah. Sorry I digressed, but it was just very... I have to tell you, as an educator that has been in this business for 26 years, you can go and find research about anything and everything if you want to prove your point. Because the reality is we know that things affect the life of the students and then that it doesn't make a difference. When you look at the number of students who are in jail, majority of them, African-American and Latino males, the first indicator that we find is they never graduate from high school. We are doing a project in Wynn Elementary School in which we have issues with mental health, severe mental health of the students pre-K to 5. And we have a partnership with the Wilder. And I look at the 11 we met this week, 11 21 students that we are serving very differently because it's a pilot. And from all those characteristics, the first thing you see, no education. Not finishing high school, teen parent, parents having mental health issues, unstable in jobs, moving from one place to another, homeless. So it's almost like you have a list of things that you know they're going to happen to families when you don't have a high school diploma. And I wanted to add, because you asked me if they need to sign, and I wasn't very clear because I don't work directly with that, and I don't want to give you the wrong impressions. And if I could ask Claudia to explain.
Thank you, Superintendent, Madam Chair, and committee members. The majority of our parents who deal with the dropout rate, they either don't speak the language or English is their second language. The sociocultural level or their expectations are not what we call high expectations. They are afraid of the systems. They don't know the law. They don't know how their law applies, or because history in their countries, this doesn't happen to us. So the majority of kids who were born in this country in their first or second generation know the system. They know how to navigate the system where the parents are not. So sometimes they go, sometimes they're signed. We look for them. They're afraid of our calls, or if they receive a letter with the state seal, they will think they will deport us. Let's don't open the letter. Let's don't answer the phone. So one thing leads to another, and it's hard and difficult to communicate the parents the law of signing, especially with our special education children. We definitely need them to get the maximum education and quality for them to be productive in life, to be self-efficient. And the majority of them will drop, and again, because they need to help the families or because they don't know what is out there. And we deal with this.
Thank you. You know, Senator Chamberlain just left, but members, he's actually correct. Research shows that this change actually has not proven to increase graduation rates. So we know that from research. This is a tool, and you know, I am supportive of it because I think that we need to add that tool to your box. But I think promising that this is going to increase graduation rates is incorrect. We have states who have passed this and have not done it. So I think it's important that we add this tool to the box. I have heard testimonies from parents, particularly from immigrant parents, who are unaware of how the system works and how this is a law that, you know, is useful. But I think it's important that we do clarify that research does show that, you know, I don't think that Senator Wigger is promising that this is going to increase graduation rates, but
yes, Madam
Senator
Chair,
Wigger.
Yeah, it's a tool. It's right. A tool that people on the front lines, we're asking to be accountable for students. And this was reiterated by former Superintendent Karstoffen from St. Paul, just saying, please give us the tools. I think we have that obligation. There's a number of things that are a part of the remedy to increase graduation, but this is a part of it. They're asking for it, and that's why we ask your consideration.
Thank you. Senator Peterson, then Senator Thompson, and then Senator Nino, and Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wigger, so we kind of covered some of the stuff that I was just going to talk about, which is the lack of research and the impact overall on academic achievement. It's not impacting graduation rates. The data shows that it's not going to be complied with and most likely not enforced by law enforcement.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I disagree with each of those
Thank
points,
you,
Senator Pearson.
Senator Wigger.
Well, there's data from organization Oropolis, the Brown Center on Education Policy at Brookings, and many other organizations that say that largely it's not going to be enforced. What is the point? I mean, if it's not going to impact academic achievement and we're talking about adding legal consequences, what was the point in bringing it forward? And if it's a tool, it seems to be an ineffective tool. And if that's the case, then why put it in statute?
Senator?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, we just heard testimony from Superintendent of Schools and the Truancy Prevention Program asking for this.
Yes.
And, you know, the county attorney, if he was here, he waited for 2 hours, they will tell you that this is needed. That's why.
Senator Peterson.
Education Commission of States has a bit of information on other states that have done it as well.
Senator Peterson, follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Wigger. I appreciate the fact that some people think it may work and may not work, but typically we make decisions based upon whether or not it in fact will make an impact, whether it in fact is good policy, not just based on requests by particular individuals to make it happen. I guess I view the bill as more of a statement of principles or a statement of an ideal that we want kids to be in school till they're 18, and so as a society we're going to pass a law that kind of makes statute reflect that. And if that's the purpose of the bill, I guess I can go with that. I will say in your defense, Senator Wigger, there isn't any data really that shows that it's detrimental either. So I guess, you know, when I look at all statutes, not just necessarily education policy, but kind of one of the key foundational elements of a good law is that, well, it's effective at whatever the goal is. It's going to be complied with by the people who fall under the law, and that it in fact can be enforced. And I don't think that this legislation, although very well intended and meets an ideal that I believe in, I don't think it meets any one of those three criteria. So I think I'll leave my comments at that, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Dahl, you had the...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I do have some concerns as a classroom teacher for 29 years, and I think about Northfield School and all we do to try to make sure that we keep students in the classroom until 18. We have a ninth grade academy, a 10th grade seminar. We have structured study halls, response to intervention. We're looking in PBIS, and there's a lot. I also think about my years of teaching social psychology, and there's something I believe is called the overjustification effect, that extrinsic motivation versus intrinsic motivation. And I think we need to concentrate on the intrinsic part. I see this as an extrinsic model. And I actually have several students in mind that says it's just not going to work for him to stay there till 18. After his sophomore year is about done, he has zero credits still. And the ALC doesn't want him. And we're still working to try to make sure he stays there. But I just can't see the long-term benefits for either the teachers or that student in this particular instance. Now, I could maybe be convinced, and I do believe that it is a tool that would work for you, but I'm not sure it's a one-size-fits-all.
Thank you. Senator Nino, Senator Thompson, and then Senator Ken. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, but the depth of my question might depend on whether this is heading over to the Judiciary Committee. Is this going to be going over to Judiciary?
Yes, Senator, it will be referred to Judiciary.
Then I don't need to get into that too much other than to highlight that what Senator Peterson referenced, that the compliance is probably going to be fairly low. And if I'm not mistaken, I've never served on Judiciary Committee, but I think parents are held criminally liable. Maybe we've got a lawyer across the table. Maybe you could help me. Criminally liable for truancy. And so now we have 16 and 17-year-olds who presumably can drive, may be very difficult to control, and may not follow the direction of their parents at all. And suddenly now we've got a new two-year period to which we're going to be criminalizing the parents. And I just wanted to express that as a concern. The Judiciary Committee can delve into that, but comment on that, because obviously it affects part of the education system, and I don't want to get much more deeper than that because that's not our purview.
Thank you, Senator Nino. I think that's a point well taken, because it will be referred to Judiciary. And just advice to the Senator, Senator Wigger, I have been thinking about it. I don't know if you want to work on an amendment to kind of put some kind of an exception in there, because there will be, a child protection, educational neglect clause in there that parents are liable for, 16-year-olds that really don't want to go to school. So that is an issue that you might want to review before it goes to Judiciary, but I think that's a good point. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Wigger, obviously a laudable goal. I think everybody at this table, of course, would wish that every young person in Minnesota would go to school through graduation and completion and get a diploma. There's no doubt about that. But I think Senator Dahl's comments really, he provided information from an experience point of view that I don't have experience on, but makes sense to me, that by the time you get 16 and 17 and 18-year-olds, if they just absolutely don't want to be there, what are you going to do? There just comes a point at which it makes sense to me. It's really difficult to address that. And, I'm thinking of belligerent 17-year-olds who really hate school and don't want to be there, and their parents getting dragged off to jail because their kids aren't in school strikes me as really an odd way to proceed. I hope that issue does get addressed in Judiciary.
Thank you, Senator.
Well, Madam Chair, members,
Senator Wigger,
you raise good points. Further discussions needed. I wish County Attorney John Choi could have been here, because they're asking for this as well,
yeah.
And truancy intervention staff are asking for this remedy, and they're calling this more than feel good, or something that something they're saying we need this, or I wouldn't be using committee time. Talked to Senator Latz right before our hearing, and mentioned that County Attorney Choi, and as well as others, would have that opportunity. I might mention the previous County Attorney, Susan Gertner, received a number of distinctions for the intervention type program that their office has had, and she previously was the president for the state County Attorneys Group, and I know there's been a lot of discussion. You're right, there are additional consequences, but the bottom line is there's a need out there, and I have a lot of faith in what we're hearing from Dr. Silva and others, and I think she'd like to comment further.
And
thank you,
Ms. Silva. Only, Madam Chair, members of the board, members of the Senate, I'm so used to talk to the board members that it comes automatically. I'm trained already. The reality is, we live in we are urban education. St. Paul Public School is urban education. 45% of our kids speak other language. So then, yes, it is different, probably the effect in other parts of the state. But what about, because the students are in the streets and they're caught doing something that is not right, they are liable for what they're doing at 16. So this has to be in the hands, maybe that's not in the bill, but in the hands of the student. If they're smart enough at 16 years old to decide to get out of school, then it's, you are going to be confronted with the punishment that goes behind that. So then that is something that our kids have to own their learning. And you are right, Senator Torres. After a while, you cannot do anything with 16-and-a-half-year-old kids. And I don't want to put many parents in a circumstance like that. But I want the students, the ones who are not showing up at school, to be responsible, because they are riding in the, they are found in the street with one or two cigarettes of marijuana, they get something, it's a punishment. So then they know what the law works. And many of them are trying to get out of being with the law, and they are trying to get jobs. So then when they're out in the street, doing whatever they do, they're not only not helping themselves, but they are damaging themselves, because, you know, without supervision. And yes, we live in Minnesota and it's cold, but they're still out there. And what about the fact that it's costing us as a society to pay for everything that goes on between those hours that they're in school?
Thank you, Ms. Silva. Senator Kent.
My question is in the same neighborhood. Back to the research issue, and if this truly makes a difference, I'm of the school that says if we keep one or two kids and help them graduate, potentially, then it's worth it. As long as there are no unintended consequences and costs, you know, like the parental liability type issue. So that would be where my concern is, making sure that we're not opening some door to cause more problems. Otherwise, it potentially is more than just feel good if we can keep, you know, get a couple kids through the system.
Ms. Silva.
Senator Torres, Claudia has more information in relationship to the technicality of the parent liability. If
Ms.
you don't
Paris.
Mind, she could
yeah,
speak.
Ms. Paris, please go ahead. And
thank you. Thank you, Madam. Senator Kent, in regards of prior Senator Thompson, I believe, at this moment, we have two different programs of intervention, and one we call FTIP, and the other one we call TIP. FTIP is for kids under the age of 12, and the responsibility relies under the parent, and we call education neglect. After the age of 12, in between 12 and 18, the responsibility lies on the student. We also take in consideration the factors of the truancy of the students. The reason for our meeting with the student in the county is to find those barriers. While we identify those barriers, either when we are with a minor under 12 or over 12, we, after taking in consideration all those barriers, we decide that maybe it is the parent who is at fault, or maybe it is the child. We consider a kid who is older than 12 years old who's able to get dressed, get up, get in, take the bus, and the mom actually doesn't have to put the clothes on, put them in the bus, and take it. So we work with those kids, and we get those kids who are 16, as Superintendent mentioned. Not all of us were very mature when we were 16 years old, but we get youth, and a 17-year-old that said, okay, I make mistakes. I wanna get back on track. And this has helped me. And I need all the support possible. And maybe I don't have a perfect family. Maybe I do have a lot of barriers. But this is helping me. In Ramsey County and with St. Paul Public Schools, we work with organizations within our community to make sure that we demolish those barriers when it comes about mental health, addictions, domestic violence, to make sure that the kids are safe at home, is safe outside. And keeping in consideration that if we all here to promote education as a right, not as a privilege, why do we have to limit it to a 16-year-old? And there's no safer place after the home of these children. There are schools. Why do we want them in the street at 16 years old?
Thank you. And Senator Kenna, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick follow-up. The other concern I would have, as you've alluded to, would be recognizing that there are differences around the state and throughout mm-hmm. different types of districts, and making sure that we're not putting some sort of one-size-fits-all limitation. And I'm not exactly sure how to address that, but I just throw that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, and I don't know who at the panel might respond, but this has been an issue for me that I have thought about it and can go both ways on the issue at times. But it seems to me that we're at a point right now in our state that we're starting to realize what a disservice we're doing to anyone to not let them graduate, not find a way to have them graduate from high school. I think previously, many years ago, you know, we started out as a farm state, and many of the farm kids, the parents didn't even think about keeping them in school. They needed them for work at home on the farm, and they kept them there. And it was a disservice. I grew up on a farm. I'm the youngest, 12th in the family of 14. My five older brothers and sisters didn't graduate from high school. A real shame. But I can't blame my mother and father. They were wonderful parents. And my father was on the school board and, you know, very active in church and community. But it's different now. We know how important it is. If there's anything, Senator Kent left now, but when she said that, you know, if we can just save one or two children from going out on the street at age 16, and you know where they're going to be. They're going to be in the court system. They're going to be in the prisons. Mm-hmm. You take a look at who's in prison. They're high school dropouts. Now, that came to me in my second year, 1988. No, it was 1990. I carried the bill for the elementary teacher preparation time, because elementary teachers were not considered to be very important in 1990. They didn't have preparation time like high school and middle school teachers did, because they were kind of like mothers. They were just kind of like mothers, didn't really do anything when they stayed home with their children. At a time, that was at the time we felt that way. We know more now than we did before. And when I had that bill, Rose Hermanson and the MFT were working with me and preparing me to carry that bill, and they told me that by second grade I think it was, the teacher can tell you who's going to be a high school dropout. And I thought, my gosh, why don't we do something about it then? Mm-hmm. And, of course, my little prevention method was to give an elementary teacher time to prepare lessons better so that she could teach better and keep the kids so they wouldn't fall behind. I'm sorry to go on like this, but it's so sad to me to see that these little children are so punished, and now you're talking about 16 and 17-year-olds. But can you imagine what it must be like to be a 5-year-old child and enter into the kindergarten room for the first time, maybe that they've gone into any sort of a school setting, and sitting next to somebody that can read, knows their numbers, knows probably all the presidents of the United States. And here you don't even know how to open a book right. And we hear this. This is true. And how does that make you feel? I can relate to them because of technology. How does it feel for some of us who aren't real literate in technology and have everybody else around you, you know, using it? I mean, your 2-year-old kids can handle their phones better than I can handle mine. And, you know, how that makes you feel very discouraged and not very proud of yourself. And if you're 2 years old or 3 years old or 5 years old and have around other kids who say, someone just told me about it, these two little children were in class, and this little girl was sitting next to a little boy, and he didn't know how to write his name, and she said, "You don't even know how to write?" That's a five-year-old talking to another five-year-old. What does that do? So I don't know. You know, I think if we can start saying this is important, and let judiciary figure out if it's really something that parents are going to be put into jail for. I don't believe that's going to happen. I really don't. I think we have more common sense in our state of Minnesota than that. And unless parents are really being neglectful, and then they should be held accountable. But, you know, I think to keep that in there for the fact that it's a message to the children, and I like what I hear from you saying that it becomes the child's responsibility. And after that, I'll just stop.
Senators, it seems that we agree that that the concept of, you know, really supporting the districts to, you know, have the tools that you need to move in the direction that we need to move is important. Yet there are concerns about, you know, offering a tool that might open the schools as well as the families to kind of some risky situations. I think that would be an important step for judiciary. I would like to encourage you, Senator Wigger, to continue the conversation with members here. I don't know if I believe that it might be necessary that we actually do work on some language to make sure that neither families and that we don't put families or schools or teachers in a vulnerable place by, you know, really just adopting this language, which for this committee, I think is an important thing. We want to give a message. Yeah, kids should stay, you know, until age 18, and we should do whatever we can to encourage them to stay and pursue, you know, a diploma, pursue graduation, all of that. We're going to be talking a lot about that. But perhaps that's something that we need to do. Senator Peterson wanted to talk, and Senator Thompson. I don't know, Senator Carlson, did you have a question? No. Okay. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Senator, I guess I believe that this is a good faith effort to do the right thing, and it's brought on by a good faith request from some of your parochial interests. And there's a lot of emotional examples and a lot of anecdotal examples about this proposal, but that's not the basis or proper foundation for a legislative proposal. You know, with all due respect to the district and some other comments that were made, nobody here is suggesting that we're not going to let kids graduate or that we don't think that kids should attend school beyond 16. It's about whether or not this is a research-based approach that's actually going to accomplish the ends that we're after. And I can tell you that I would hope, and I know that the chair won't let this happen, that this is not seen as a solution to any of those issues, because there are plenty of research-based approaches around effective teaching and early intervention programs that actually do have plenty of research that show that it increases years of attendance and increases graduation rate. But this is a legislative proposal that's built upon a foundation that, to me, is emotional and anecdotal, and I don't think that's the proper basis for legislation.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, we could just a real quick one. Is there a fiscal note on this? Because obviously we're going to be having a lot more school resources used to try to enforce rules against another group of people. And then is this bill headed for taxes after judiciary?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, yes, there would be a fiscal note because the system books for failure. And if we were to get a couple more people to graduate, then we would have to reimburse, and I say, great, those additional pupils that walk the stage. But we'll get that estimate.
Thank you, Senator. And I was just given the fiscal note, so after judiciary, I presume this will be referred to your committee, Senator Wigger.
Madam Chair, members, yes, there's a lot of discussion yet. And
okay. Thank you.
Your points have been well noted and appreciated.
So there will be yet another stop in Senator Weaver's committee. Any more questions, senators? If not, I would like to move. Senator Weaver, please go ahead and present the motion.
Madam Chair, and again, members, thank you, and to testifiers and to others that want to provide additional feedback, I'm very open for doing that. I would move that Senate File 160 as amended, recommended to pass and re-refer to the Judiciary Committee.
On that motion, all of those in favor signify by saying yes.
Madam yes. Chair, roll call.
Yes. Senator Peterson has requested a roll call. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Torres Ray.
Yes.
Senator Dahl.
No.
Senator Nelson. Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Chamberlain.
Yes.
Senator Clausen.
Yes.
Senator Franzen.
Yes.
Senator Johnson.
Yes.
Senator Kent.
Yes.
Senator Nenow.
No.
Senator Peterson.
No.
Senator Rood. Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Weaver?
Yes.
Senator Wicklund?
Yes.
We have 9 yes and 4 no's. The bill is recommended to go to judiciary.
Thank you.
Thank you very
thank
much,
you, Senator. Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Ms. Perez and Ms. Silva, for waiting for us and providing testimony. We really appreciate it. Members, let's try to have a presentation. Hopefully, we are able to cover. And your agenda is number 3, and we have 3 presenters, but we are not going to have the time to cover the 3. But it will be, I think, important that we review a couple of frames that will come to us around testing and evaluation. One comes from kind of direct application of how testing and evaluation works, and then the other one is really a very broad overview of the different tests and evaluation processes that are offered, in the state, and so that we have a clear sense of how this system works. And I would like to ask Senator Dahl to continue to chair our committee, since he's going to be leading the working committee on that issue.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Heisted, and I believe, will you be testifying by yourself or will Ms. Dugan be joining you, or are you doing it separately?
Dr. Dugan will follow my presentation, I will keep this relatively short so that she'll have time to speak as well.
Thank you. Please proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
My name is Dr. Dave Heisted. I'm the Executive Director of Research at Bloomington Public Schools. Prior to that, I spent 25 years as Evaluator and Research Director in Minneapolis Public Schools. Today, I've been asked to give a broad overview of the types of assessments that are given to our children, starting at an early age and going all the way up through high school. And to indicate some of the purposes of these assessments, the way the assessments are administered, and basically just to start a conversation with the senators on your questions about assessment in the state. Now, I'm going to cover just the assessments that are mandated either by the federal government, by the state, or by local districts. And there are lots of assessments that are given by teachers on a day-to-day basis. Those, in my mind, are the most important assessments. Those are the ones that are guiding instruction on a day-to-day basis and helping our children focus on the skills that they need the most. The assessments that I'll be talking about are very important, but they are for different purposes than that. I prepared a short PowerPoint, and I wanted to start with this picture of the pathways to graduation. It is the mission kind of statement of Bloomington Public Schools that everything that we do be related to getting students on course for various pathways for post-secondary. And those pathways start as early as birth and go all the way up through high school and beyond. And so I like this graphic because it indicates, as with height and physical development, we also have areas of cognitive development that we need to assess along the way. Those assessments need to be appropriate to the child, to the purposes of the assessment, and to be as efficient as possible so that we aren't taking time away from instruction with assessments that aren't needed. I will refer back to this pathways idea. The first assessment that I thought I would talk about is the preschool screener. We actually start assessing children in ages 3 through 5. And the purpose of this assessment is to have a developmental check point. We check vision and hearing and those kinds of physical things, as well as gross motor. But we have a cognitive assessment that all districts are required to work with the community to assess children, and the earlier the better. It's preferred that children are screened between ages 3 and 4 so that if students need additional intensive assessment, they can get it as early as possible. The main purpose is to link up with quality pre-K programs. There is a cut score on each one of these preschool assessments that is used to refer to special education teachers to decide if the students need intensive special education services starting before kindergarten. But there are also a group of students that you might say are in the gray area, that they're not really at that level of needing intensive special ed services, but they are at risk for not being ready for kindergarten. And in Bloomington, we have programs designated by the district and in working with the community to make sure that we hook up children to these kinds of services. Now, the assessment covers some areas like language and pre-literacy skills, attention and behavior. In Minneapolis Public Schools, I helped design the preschool instrument that is used there. We have questions about kind of general knowledge, what is a window made of, things like that. But we have, can you hear the sounds of words, the beginning sounds of words, or can you match a rhyming card? There are different kinds of skills in language and pre-literacy that predict being ready for kindergarten, as well as doing gross motor and other kinds of things. Now, families use this information then to help their children get into preschool services. Unfortunately, even though we've had great success in getting many students assessed before the age of 4, we still, in Minneapolis and in Bloomington, the two districts I know the best, have a number of students who don't have any preschool screening until they show up in kindergarten. So I emphasize the importance of this. It's not something that's used for accountability purposes, but it is an important assessment. Next, I want to talk about beginning of kindergarten assessments. Now, the state assessments that are administered to meet the federal requirements start at age 3. So the No Child Left Behind assessments that Dr. Dugan's going to talk about in more depth, you know, are trying to assess whether students have read or reading by the third grade, which is critically important. But if the students aren't reading well by third grade, we should have known something about that a long time before that. So starting at the beginning of kindergarten, we need to assess pre-literacy skills and pre-numeracy kinds of skills before you're actually reading. There are skills in terms of vocabulary and oral comprehension, listening to the teacher read a story and then answer questions about the story, knowing your letters. Do you know the names of the letters and the sounds that go with the letters? So these are the components of this oral reading assessment. And there's some basic numeracy items like counting backwards or counting forwards or counting up to 35. And so these kinds of skills then predict whether students are on track to be reading by grade 3. So almost all the districts in the metro area use some form of kindergarten assessment. There isn't a single statewide assessment, but there's a committee now. The state received some Race to the Top funds that were dedicated for early childhood, and there's a committee at MDE to look at which are the highest quality assessments, and we'll be recommending out of that committee you know, which assessments really meet the purpose. So the main purpose is screening, but it also, the kindergarten assessment provides information to preschool providers how well did their children do after they graduated from the preschool program. And so Head Start and a number of agencies that work closely with Minneapolis Public Schools get a report back from Minneapolis Public Schools on how their students did on the kindergarten assessment. So it gives kind of a summative indicator of how well did we do getting kids ready for the kindergarten standards. It also serves as a pretest for measuring growth. So we know that children have to be reading fluently by the end of first grade to really be on track for future success. And so we can use this kindergarten measure then to show how students perform later on and track the growth. So there is a little bit of an accountability sense that you try to measure the performance of programs and schools on these measures as well. Next, I'll talk about grades 1 and 2. By the time you get to grade 1, children should be reading from text. They should know their letters. They should be you know, actually reading simple text and being able to answer questions. So in Minneapolis and Bloomington, we have oral reading assessments that have been standardized, and we also have a test that's called the MAP for Primary. It's a Northwest Evaluation Association test where the children can take items on the computer. As early as first grade, you know, I think if it's like my home, the children are much more advanced than the adults in terms of their use of the computer. It requires some simple computer knowledge to be able to take this assessment. And it also involves, you know, fluency, comprehension, vocabulary, simple number sense, geometric concepts, etc. Families get this information. It's not high stakes. It's really for diagnosis, strengths and weaknesses. What area of literacy are we doing well in? What areas can we work with the teacher and with other support staff to improve? There's something called response to intervention, which is we'll look at these scores and then see what kind of modifications we can make. So the children that are struggling in these basic learning to read and numeracy then get extra support, and then we check again to see how students are doing later on. So these kinds of assessments before the third grade MCA is even given are really critical. And you know, it depends on the resources in the district. And we had a conference in Bloomington where we shared the kindergarten assessments from Bloomington and Minneapolis. And a number of people came and said, we just don't have the funding to be able to do what you're doing. We haven't had the resources to really follow through. More and more, we're realizing that the prevention of dropout really begins at these early ages. It's not something that we start working on in high school. You really need to be doing these initial assessments of whether students are on track. And so in Minneapolis and most of the, I'd say over half of the districts in the state use this assessment called the Measures of Academic Progress. Its abbreviation is MAP. And the purpose of this assessment is actually to measure learning, the amount of learning that takes place from the beginning of the year to the end of the year, from one year to another, to really hold ourselves accountable as educators for growth and performance, as well as whether our kids are above average or not. Now, you can't have schools and classrooms where all the students start above average, but if those students aren't accelerating at higher rates, making great growth, then they're going to fall behind, and they're not going to reach their potential. Unfortunately, the No Child Left Behind approach hasn't really paid attention to the top of the distribution. Most of the emphasis has been on the kids that are struggling. Well, in both cases, you need to get accurate assessment not only of the proficiency but also growth. And in the case of the MAP test, it was designed for that purpose. There's a computerized assessment format where the children will answer the first question. If they get the answer wrong, they'll get an easier question. And if they keep getting answers wrong, they'll get finally down into a level of the assessment that they can show some success at. Now, if the student is in third grade reading at the seventh grade level, the student would branch right into those more difficult questions. And so you'd actually find out what the ability of those students are. Well, this is very important for measuring growth, is that you have accuracy in identifying kids at both extremes, that your special needs students don't end up giving up on the test and start crying because it's too hard, that you can actually assess English language learners and special education students with a test that's appropriate to them. It also happens to be the best predictor of college readiness. The MAP test has these properties of accuracy with small measurement error, what you'd call the margin of error, kind of like in surveys, so that it has really high predictive powers. So you can predict as early as grade 2 with, you know, about 75 to 80% accuracy whether the student's going to be on track in grade 8. And if they aren't, what do we need to do to make some changes to get there? So this is a standardized test. It covers the basic areas of math and geometric concepts, algebraic concepts, computation, and fluency, vocabulary comprehension, and inferential comprehension as well. So it's like a typical state test, but this idea of branching and the fact that it has a growth scale that starts all the way from kindergarten and goes to grade 12 gives you the possibility of really following the pathway of a student very accurately. And I'll show you a picture of that. Here are the pathways that we put together in Bloomington. We, in the purple line at the bottom, is really on track for graduation. So we can find out early on whether students using this MAP test are on track for graduation, or the blue line is on track for a two-year college, or the green is on track for a basic four-year college. And yellow is, the University of Minnesota campus now has really high eligibility criteria for getting in. And then the red at the top there was Carleton. I just thought, there are people that are looking for different kinds of pathways, different kinds of expectations. And if we can find out in fifth grade that a student isn't on track for their real goal, if they really wanted to be able to go to a four-year college and get a degree in business, well, the indicators might be that your math, your reading, really aren't on track yet. So then what do you do to hit those pathways? Now, we shared this information with middle school parents at one of the middle schools in Bloomington, and they found it very interesting. You know, they had already started to think about college kinds of things, but we need to have the students thinking about college readiness as well. And there are some tests called the Explore the Plan and the ACT that I'm going to talk about. These are the tests that the committee, the Achievement Committee, is recommending that we move to because they're very high college readiness kinds of standards. Well, I can from the MAP assessment predict whether you're on track for those college readiness standards as well. So this is just a basic concept that says we need to be measuring all the way along the line with assessments designed for the specific purpose. Now, the problem could be that you might have multiple assessments aligned to one purpose and no assessments for another. For example, you need diagnostic assessments that really tell you what to work on in reading. And teachers are really good at giving those diagnostic assessments. But if you had three of those diagnostic assessments in the district, it might not be as efficient as if you had one. And you could have accountability assessments. You might have too many assessments that are for public reporting to tell whether students are at the standard or not. You might only need one. So where I look at the question of over-testing is, what's the purpose? Can we find the assessment that's most efficient in measuring that purpose so that we don't over-test, but not blanketly state that we're testing too much or too little? It really depends on the purpose. So the MAP test is really used extensively in the state of Minnesota. There are other tests like that. And what the committee was recommending is we should be looking at assessments that are of that type, that measure performance on a continuum, that branch and allow you to go way above or below the grade level, as well as testing the standard level, and that that might be something for the future iteration of state tests. Now, like I said, I think Dr. Dugan can best express, you know, what the state tests look like. These are the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments in Reading, Math, and Science, and the English Language Learner Assessments called the ACCESS. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that right now, but I would like in just a brief minute to talk about this Explore Plan and ACT. Now, these are college readiness assessments. The Explore is given in 8th grade. The Plan is given in 10th grade, and the ACT is a college entrance test in 11th or 12th grade. And there was a study that really empirically demonstrated what levels of performance you'd have to have on these tests to be on track for getting a B in college in English or in math or in social studies. So there's a lot of work that's been done to establish what readiness really looks like with these assessments. These are high standards assessments. They aren't like a minimum grad kind of a test. And the committee that was headed up by Matt Mose, you know, really wanted to give a recommendation that we concentrate on those high standards, that we be working on college readiness starting as early as middle school, and that you know, this would be the type of assessment, not that these particular tests would be what we'd recommend, but the type of assessment. So that's all I had prepared for a brief overview. I know you probably have some questions, so be glad to take
yes, those. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heistad, a question regarding the mode of how you have these tests being taken by the students. It seems to be by computer. I met recently with some teachers, actually in Bloomington, part of the district that I represent, and they were talking to me about the challenge of having some kids that are moving to the state that might not have seen a computer ever in their life.
Yes.
And then you're putting them in front of a computer to take these assessments. Can you talk about
yes.
that
Senator
challenge?
Franz and
Mr. Heistad.
And Chair, I agree that it's a challenge for some students learning how to use the mouse, et cetera. It's usually more of a challenge for the teachers and the adults in the room than it is the kids. But what I find is that even at kindergarten and first grade, children that are given some brief experience with the mouse can do these assessments pretty readily. We piloted the kindergarten and first grade map for primary in Minneapolis, and Nellie Stone Johnson was a high poverty school, 95% free and reduced lunch, and students of color, and they loved it. You know, the kids loved it. But actually, in another school that was less high poverty, they said, gosh, the kindergarten test was too hard for the kids. We felt so sorry for them. So we want to keep the original kindergarten assessment, which actually I didn't mention. The kindergarten assessment, we have retired kindergarten teachers sitting with the teacher, with the students, and doing it one-on-one, listening to them do their letters, et cetera. And I do like that format. But it is more expensive than the computerized. But more and more, kids are getting used to doing tests on a computer. Almost all the certification exams are now on the computer. Eventually, all the college entrance exams will be on the computer. But we have to move at the rate that we're ready for it. In Bloomington, we didn't have enough labs, and so you get loss of time for instruction by using the labs for assessment too much. So we decided to do a lot of paper and pencil MCA tests, as long as that's available. Eventually, I think most of the tests from like second grade on will be on the computer, and we may even find that some of these really early ages can be on the computer. The tests, you know, like the kindergarten first grade tests are more like 20 minutes to 40 minutes per time, so children aren't expected to sit for an hour and a half. When you get up to the MAP test, they're usually 45 minutes at a setting, and then state tests can take longer than that for different students. ELL students sometimes take a lot more time.
Senator Franson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was my follow-up on students who are not only never seen a computer ever in their life, but also have the language challenge, yes. Cultural challenge, and how do you have a set standard of how you perform these tests? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Franson, we translate the assessments, the early assessments, into Somali, Hmong, and Spanish. We have translations for the MAP test, for the math, but for the reading, you actually have to read the reading in English. We do have lots of dual language programs where they're testing Spanish as well as English. There are accommodations for ELL students, and there's a particular ELL assessment that I'll have Dr. Dugan talk about. But I do think it is a challenge for non-English speakers to take some of these math tests with the really long word problems, and you wonder whether you're really testing math or if you're testing language sometimes. So it's a constant challenge to have accommodations that are fair but not change the basic nature of the test.
Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my first question actually would be if it's possible to get a copy of this presentation to have.
Yeah, I've got some extra copies along.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. And my next question may actually be better for Dr. Dugan, but just in case, I'd be interested to hear your perspective. One of the things we keep hearing about, whether it's in discussions about funding or policy, is the challenges when things that are done in this building are inconsistent from year to year. And I know from watching some of these discussions in my school district that some of the changes with the MCAs where all of a sudden, one year it moves to being on the computer, and then that messes with results, whether that's a methodological mm-hmm. issue or whether there's something that's being tweaked in the test itself. And so you end up with fluctuations. And I'm just curious if you have any comments on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kent, there are changes when the standards change and the tests are recalibrated, and sometimes you see scores change a lot. We went to the MCA 3s and the scores dropped. It wasn't necessarily because of the way the test was administered, but actually the items became more difficult. And so, you know, you couldn't compare apples to apples. That's one of the reasons I like this NWA test, that the scale never changes. There has been a lot of work on computerized versus paper and pencil tests, and in general they found no difference. That doesn't mean that a particular individual might not have more difficulty with the computer, and we do recommend that kids take practice tests on the computer. I think the Department of Education checks to make sure if there are differences. If there actually were systematic differences where the computerized would be higher scores or lower, they'd have to adjust those. I think there's just a feeling sometimes that the computerized might be more difficult for students. But what I found with the MAP test, it seems like you might have more motivation, that the kids that are at the top that may rush through the test actually are challenged to have more difficult items, and they may actually have a better performance. But, yeah, there are changes that are necessitated when the standards change. And then I think the general idea is that we would end up on the computers for efficiency and for preparing kids for the world of work, where they're going to be on computers a lot. But I know there's still a lot of feelings about that, especially in Bloomington.
Senator Claussen, then Peterson.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation today. And I like what we're seeing. We look at each grade level that we're using assessments to really improve student learning, and that's really the purpose, what we're looking at. So just a couple comments. I think one of the things that we've done in Minnesota, a real disservice to education and to students, is we've tried to make teachers hit about six different targets out there, whether it's MCAs, the ACT. If we're really interested in college readiness, we should really move to the ACT model that you've kind of showed us a progression to show us, are you college ready in eighth grade? If not, what can we do about that? Let's check it in 10th grade. Are you ready? Well, if not, what can we do about that? Do we need a grad test in math? Use the college readiness score in the ACT. Why invent another test? Throw out the AccuPlacer. It's an SAT-based test. 75% of our students in Minnesota take the ACT. Why are we doing that when it doesn't mesh with what teachers are teaching in the classroom? And we can use a CUT score, again, that college readiness test that students take in 12th grade off the ACT, whether or not you need a remedial class in college, and eliminate a lot of this testing so we're consistent and we're shooting at a target, not several targets, over the course of a student's life and education. Those are my – I just was on my soapbox.
Mr. Chair and Senator Claussen, I like the idea of empirically establishing standards with some very important goal, like college readiness and working backwards. And so I am frustrated sometimes that the standards change.
Right.
And so from one grade level, you know, standard might be at the 35th percentile nationally, and by the time you get up to 11th grade, the standard's at the 75th percentile nationally. It makes the state look like kids are learning less when it's actually the tests were getting more difficult and the bar was getting higher. So, yeah, establishing empirical CUT scores has a great appeal to me. Yeah.
Just one last comment. I think
Senator Claussen. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Dole. I think the greatest disservice that is not representing Minnesota as that math score at the ACE with the AccuPlacer in college. That exam is totally inconsistent with what teachers are teaching in the classroom and what they're being focused on through the MCAs and college readiness for the ACT. And I think it's a huge disservice. That's my last comment. Thank you.
Thank you. And Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heistad, one of the things I appreciate so much about your presentations is you have a ability to clearly articulate your point. And I've seen your presentation before with the tree and the prairie and the tree and the rocky
soil. Yeah, the value added.
So some other people may have seen it as well. And just for the sake of the committee, so often when you're talking about assessment, people talk about the nightmare anecdote situation where you know, the kid, there's X percentage of ELL kids in a class or X percentage of ELL kids in general in a school district, and there's poverty and there's diverse racial backgrounds and all of these things, and oftentimes they're all together. All three of those things are together. Could you just talk a little bit about kind of the inherent ability of assessment to account for environmental factors, and because oftentimes those are the things that we hear about from teachers or practitioners or parents that look at a situation that looks horrible, and how could anyone possibly succeed in that situation? But just provide some, I think you know where I'm going with my question, provide some of your own analysis as it relates to the capability of assessment.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, the way that the assessments are used, have been used for No Child Left Behind, the scores have typically been reduced down to a 0-1. You're either proficient or not. And the percentage of proficiency then was used as a proxy for school quality. And that was a very difficult situation for schools where they might have changing demographics, increasing ELL populations. They might have one school would have more special ed students than others, et cetera. So there is a burgeoning field of analysis called value-added analysis. And I know there's been testimony from the from Sanders from Tennessee at different times here. But the idea is that you hold schools and teachers and all of us working in a district accountable for how much learning takes place. But if you just look at the proficiency rates, you can be misled that actually the proficiency can go down because students coming in had lower proficiency to start with. And it also can be misleading because of the factors you've indicated. There are different rates of poverty, different rates of English language learners. Sometimes you get a group of students that come in really low and sometimes really high. And if you just so measuring growth and then building in these other fairness factors is really what's the essentials to value-added analysis. And now the State Committee on Teacher Evaluation have recommended approach to value added using the state test, but it would apply to the MAP test or any other test with good psychometric characteristics to measure growth and then really compare yourself to like kinds of schools in the state or like kinds of classrooms. So you'd be compared fairly, taking into account the poverty level, etc. And while it's not a perfect system, there's still measurement error. It's much more fair than the typical use of the data. So the assessments that tend to be best suited to value-added are those that have a really good scale score, like the MAP test. The MCA has a solid scale score. It's not a developmental scale score. But you have to have an assessment that measures the standards very well, but very accurately. And so some kinds of assessments don't work as well because they have too much uncertainty, rate or error, or they aren't not stable across time, something like that. But the assessments we have in Minnesota are pretty high-quality assessments. And if we use the right system for holding ourselves accountable, then I think they're going to be fair as well.
Before we see if there's any final questions, I do want to apologize to Jennifer Dugan from the Department of Education. We are not going to have time, and we want to do justice to your expertise and your wisdom and make sure you get our full attention with a full committee. So I really apologize on behalf of the committee and the chair, and hope to hear from you. I've been fortunate to visit with you in my office, but we look forward to visiting with you. With that, is there any other questions? And do you, Dr. Heisted, you said that you were going to leave some things to her, but is there anything you wanted to comment, perhaps, on something she might be bringing before us before we let you go?
At this time, I wouldn't comment in depth about the grad testing, but I have done some analysis that seems to indicate that if we continued with our current grad test cut scores, especially for the math test, we would end up having lots of kids not graduate who would be on track for a four-year college. And so that concerned me and brought it to the attention of the work group, and would be glad to give more specific testimony about that in the future if the Senate would like that. But beyond that, I think having a basic grounding in what the assessments look like is really important. I really appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today. Thank you.
Any other questions? I'll turn the gavel back over to the chair. Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Senator Dole. Members, as you can tell, you know, our committee time is being, we're challenged to try to figure out how are we going to reschedule our next hearing, because we do have an agenda, and now we have to figure out how do we continue this presentation. I think this presentation is very important. This is an issue that we really want to target this year and want to make progress on this. So I'm very happy that Senator Dahl and Senator Nino will be helping us kind of lead that effort in their working committee. So we will continue this presentation. I know that I have a representative of social workers here, and I would like to ask her. She asked that she be included to testify. I don't know if you could come back. Yes, sorry, I can't. Yes. Is it possible that you will be back probably next Tuesday? Thank you. Thank you so much. We really apologize. We didn't intend to do this, but this presentation from social workers that work with the schools right now intends to give you an overview of the level of stress that kids are going through and teachers are going through in terms of, you know, preparing for the test and dealing with these times, and how they are seeing an increasing number of kids, you know, kind of visiting them and really struggling. And they see that the performance in these tests are just not, you know, these kids struggle to perform as a result of their stress. So I thought that would be an important issue for this committee as well. But for now, we are going to conclude this presentation, and I will let you know how we're going to rearrange our presentations for the next committees. So for now, we are adjourning. Thank you, members.